There's no I in team, but there is one in Indeed, and that's the hiring platform that you need to build yours. When you're hiring, you need Indeed. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring platform that can help you do it all. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring all in one place so easy because Indeed does the hard work for you. They show you the candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately after you post so you can hire faster. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Offer good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. And support the show by saying that you heard it on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Before we get started with this episode of Benched with Bubba, a couple things to talk to you about. First, the listener league, League 2, is up and running. Just need a few more people to sign up for it. If you're interested in playing the league, 15-team Roto League, just give a rating review on iTunes, and we'll get you right on in that league. So come check it out, Listener League 2, over on Fantrax. Also, go check out the Fantasy Black Book. I cover the catchers and the relief pitchers over there. 20th edition gets you ready for your fantasy baseball drafts. Fantasy Black Book by Joe Pisapia, the 10th edition of the Fantasy Baseball Black Book. Also, I'm doing a lot of work over at Rotoballer this year, doing season-long and DFS content. If you want to get in on the action, go check it all out right now. 50% off the total package. And if you use promo code Bubba, B-U-B-B-A, you get an extra 10% off. So you can get the whole season MLB package for 60% off over at Rotoballer. You cannot miss out on that. It is a great deal. All the content, all the tools, all the great stuff for DFS and season long, a total of 60% off if you use promo code Bubba. So go check that out on Rotoballer. But for now, speaking of Rotoballer, I got a special guest on Bench with Bubba, episode 253, talking spring training, some advanced stats like outs above average, barrels, TGFBI, and more with Eric Samulski of Rotoballer. Hope you all enjoy. Everybody, to another episode of Benched with Bubba, episode 253. Got a special guest, first timer on the show. You can find his work over at Rotoballer on Twitter at SamskyNYC. Eric Samulski, how we doing, man?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. Great to have you on the show.
Happy to be on.
I mentioned the Rotoballer thing before we dig into everything. Let everybody know what you got going on.
Yeah, so I'm up on Rotoballer right now. I've been doing a couple of different pieces, looking into barrels, who's kind of like who's got some regression coming their way, who had some progress last year, whether that's sticky or not. And then I started looking into that StatCast OAA metric, which is outs above average. They've had it for a couple of years for the outfield, basically just kind of measuring as a defender on each individual defensive play. How many outs above major league average that defender is able to get. And they released it this year with the infielders as well. So now you kind of get a whole sense of a team's entire defense, how good that defense is. And then the cool thing about StatCast is you're able to check that when a pitcher is on the mound too. So I can look up a particular pitcher and see the quality of defense that that his team plays in general, but also while he's specifically been on the mound. So it's a brand new thing that they've got with all players. So we're just kind of playing around with it and then seeing what we can pull out from it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how deep it keeps going. It's fun seeing all the new metrics. I know I felt like an idiot once I asked you, what's OAA? Once you said, I'm like, oh, yeah, no duh.
No, that, yeah, makes, I mean, that made sense when you said it.
There's new things coming out every day. Once you kind of keep up with something, there's a new thing coming out.
Well, I didn't know if it was a StatCast or a RotoBaller thing, because like RotoBaller, we have RBEVR and all these different things. Yeah. So I'm like, okay, so what is this? And then I'm like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
I haven't done a math or a numbers class since college, and every time I'm, you know, getting back into baseball, I feel like I'm getting that dose of numbers and math and all that.
Man, I've said it for like people that maybe listen back to like episode one. I still kind of can be at times. I will never say I'm not. I was very Neanderthal like type person. Sure. When it came to any new stat, I was like, nope, this is the way we do things. And I've embraced them, and I keep learning them, and I have so much more to learn. Like, I have nowhere close to probably you and many others. Like, I'm always learning every day. That's one thing that's cool about hosting the podcast is I get to learn things all the time. It's cool.
I made the same transition. I mean, you know, I used to play, and I kind of did the whole old school, like, I judge everything by my eyes. If I see the way the pitch moves, if I see the way the swing looks, that's more important than anything else. And I think you just kind of realize the more you watch, the more you pay attention that, you know, it doesn't have to be all or nothing, that middle ground is super interesting. And, you know, kind of like, you know, what I've had to learn to do is it's similar to when you look at a particular player, right? And there's that new sleeper that everybody's infatuated with. And all of a sudden, you know, that draft price soars because everybody's focused on that guy. And it's the same thing with a stat. You get a new stat and it's all everybody wants to talk about. And sometimes we, you know, we have to take a breath and see that it's just one in a number of stats and try to see which ones are really, you know, more useful. And sometimes you know, it's interesting, but maybe not actionable.
100%. Like, we're seeing more and more of these guys say that are doing the heavy lifting, and then I get to kind of act like I know what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
And they're showing how barrels are one of the stickiest, you know, best stats. They're showing, you know, line drive, exit velocity is pretty strong. Then there's all these other ones that they're nice, but are they really worth, you know, trusting so often? So it's interesting to see how it all plays out, because each stat tells a story. It's how you put each story together to give like the overall picture. And that's the fun part about it. And you mentioned how you played and you used to be like all the, you know, just with the eyes. And I'm 100% with you, because that's how I was. And I still feel like I am. I feel like I've made it maybe like a 60-40. Like 60%, I still trust the eye test. As a guy like yourself that played, you know, like baseball, you know, superstitions, a lot of streaks, like you're feeling it or you're not. There's so, like I tell people, when for my season long approach on things, doing daily fantasy helps me so much, because you learn the splits and when guys are streaking and like all these different types of deals. And I still think there's a lot to it, because like there's no way to mathematically analyze if a guy's, you know, on a hot streak type thing.
Right.
There really isn't. And so I still use it. How much do you say you still use the eye test when you're evaluating?
I think I still use it as much as I can. I mean, the beauty of, you know, well, Major League Baseball is a little behind all the other sports in terms of, you know, being able to get a lot of access to clips and all that online. It seems like, you know, people are talking about it right now with all the spring training games. You know, there's not a lot on TV. Anytime you get a good clip or an at-bat up on Twitter, somebody's going to come up and pull it down. So, you know, it's not as easy as some of the other sports, but, you know, in 2020, we're still pretty spoiled with how much we have access to online. So I try to watch, you know, as much as I can of, you know, pitchers and certain hitters at bats. And I think, you know, I trust my eyes, I guess. I mean, you know, I trust numbers, sure. But I, you know, I guess I try to make it, if I can see a guy, I think I trust what I see. And just kind of hope that, you know, maybe it clarifies the numbers a little bit, you know, but I look at how easy it is, I think your point, to take a number and maybe take it out of the context of the game. In particular, like recently, I think my big pet peeve has been how easy people make it seem to just, oh, well, if he just raises his launch angle. He just has to raise his launch angle.
So easy to do. Just do it. Try to raise your launch angle, guys.
Exactly. I mean, raising your launch angle changes an entire swing. So like my guy right now that, you know, I'm a little bit lower on than everybody else is Yandy Diaz, because everybody's like, well, he has a 5.4 launch angle. If he just raises his launch angle with how hard he hits the ball, then he's going to, you know, crush 25, 30, whatever homers. But sure, but in order to raise his launch angle, he needs to change around his entire swing. And yes, these guys are gifted hitters, and a lot of them can do that and still make the same quality of contact, but not everybody. It's not a given. I mean, I think, you know, you saw last year with somebody like Travis Shaw, who was a 30 plus home run hitter and then changed his swing, and all of a sudden he couldn't hit anything. And he said, you know, he changed his swing and he couldn't get out of his own way. So, you know, sometimes it's not as easy as the numbers make it seem.
Yeah, and there's guys like Daniel Murphy that have proven you can do it. Like, it's possible, but like you're saying, it's like for every Daniel Murphy, there's probably 20 guys that try and just makes them worse. Yeah. So it's so hard. Like, look at Wilson Ramos, for crying out loud. I think his launch angle was literally zero last year. Zero. So just imagine what he could do if you wanted to play that game. But yeah, that we can go down a rabbit hole on this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
The whole time. But let's get back on track, because you got a TGFBI pick to make on air.
I do, yeah. Soon. I'm on the clock right now.
So we got to get that before you get the dreaded auto pick. But we got to go over some recent spring training news real quick, just to keep people in the loop on what's going on and kind of how we would approach the situation. And we'll start with Giancarlo Stanton. Calf strain, another injury from Giancarlo. I was telling someone, at least it's not like a core injury like we've seen in the past, but it's still a calf injury. They're already saying he's probably going to miss the start of the season. He's been going after pick 100 in recent online drafts, which is interesting. How are you approaching Stanton? Is there a price tag that you will be buying in on Stanton?
I mean, sure. I never want to say never. I'm just super hesitant after all the years because, you know, you're taking a massive roll of the dice. And I know where his ADP was. You know, everybody kept saying, why not wait and get Miguel Sano for, you know, 40 picks, 50 picks less, and still, you know, have some of that same power. If he's going after 100, I'm a little bit more interested, just because it's more in that range where you get out of him what you can. And if he's hurt and you have to release him or put him on the IL, if you're in a league with an IL spot, and grab somebody else, then you're not wasting as much value as if he's your, you know, third, fourth, fifth round pick. I think I'd probably need to see him drop somewhere in like the I don't know, man, like the 120s, 130s. I mean, right now, Chris Davis is going in the TGFBI ADP, Chris Davis is 155. And that's a 40 plus home run bat. I mean, I don't know that I can take Stanton at 100 if I can wait 50 picks and roll the dice on Chris Davis.
Yeah, Davis is one that I like to compare. Miguel Sano at like 115 is a monster bat. You can get Franmil Reyes later on. There's a lot of interesting power bats if you want like a similar situation as Giancarlo. I'm a big Giancarlo fan. I usually don't draft him early. When he's going in the fifth round, I was intrigued. Now it's getting a little questionable. It's almost like if I think I can handle the weight game, sure. Otherwise, I'll probably pass. With Giancarlo being out till at least start the season, you know, you have Mike Tauchman there. I really don't think Clint Frazier ever gets a chance anymore. That's
such a crappy situation.
In the whole deal. Makes no sense at all. Yeah. And you know, eventually Aaron Hicks will be back. And there's other movement, like they're trying Miguel Andujar on the outfield, so on and so forth. Who would you think is the beneficiary to maybe draft for right now?
You know, I think it depends on the size of the league. If I'm in a 12 team, I'll take a late flyer on Tauchman because he's got a spot. You know, according to Roster Resource right now, I mean, he is the left fielder. The issue, you know, I mean, I guess they have him slotted in at the bottom of the lineup, which, you know, it's still a good lineup. There's RBI opportunity. There's run scoring opportunity. If he's hitting nine and you got LeMahieu, Judge, Torres coming up after him. So if I'm in a 12-team league and one of my last few picks, I'll take a shot on him because, you know, I think that he's, you know, he proved last year that he can put up some numbers. You know, he's not somebody who's going to run away with a category for you. But, you know, he's a 22.8 O-swing guy, so he doesn't chase a lot outside of the zone. 85.8 zone contact percentage. He's got an 11.5% walk percentage. So he's going to get on base. He's going to make solid contact. His ground ball percentage was down last year and his fly ball percentage was up, which is why he knocked out a few more home runs than in years past. So I feel like there's there's some minimal value. And on a good offense like that, I'll take the accumulation. In deeper leagues, though, I got to tell you, if you're like in a 15-teamer still drafting like TGFBI towards the end, I kind of like taking a stab at Mike Ford. You know, Ford's listed as a first baseman, so he can't really play in the outfield like Tauchman, but he's a lefty. He can slot in at DH against righties, whereas, you know, Andujar is a righty. And Mike Ford's numbers last year, you know, he had a better barrel percentage than Mike Tauchman. He had a higher exit velo than Mike Tauchman. His X stats are all higher than Mike Tauchman's were. He's got a lower K percentage than Tauchman does. He had a 301 ISO last year. Tauchman was 227. He also doesn't chase a lot of pitches outside of the zone. He has an 8.1 swinging strike percentage, 88.3 zone contact. So, you know, he's a big left-handed hitter with that short porch and right field. In a deep league, I'm going to take my shot on him and see if he can get some DH at-bats. And, you know, as we were mentioning streakiness early on, all it takes is to start the season with a couple home runs in your back pocket, proving that you need to be in the lineup.
Totally. Ford definitely worth the gamble. If Voit gets banged up again as well, Ford can slide in and see some definite playing time as the power is legit with him. So would be easy to see. We'll stay with the pinstripes here. This one's kind of a done deal. It broke during my recording yesterday with James Anderson. I'll get your opinion on this now. Luis Severino, he had Tommy John surgery on Thursday. As we are recording, he is in recovery. All reports were great, of course, coming back from the Yankees. But he's done till for all of this year until probably middle of next year or so. They're already missing James Paxton for a while. He said he's ahead of schedule, but that injury still scares me. So it looks like Jordan Montgomery, Jonathan Loaisiga are sliding into the spots in the back of that rotation. How are you approaching this situation in New York?
You know, I've always been, I guess always, since 2017, you know, I've been a Montgomery fan. I do like, it's another one of those guys that, you know, I'm from New York, so the Yankees are on all the time. I saw him pitch a bunch during that season. I kind of like the way that he just approaches things on the mound. I like the way he pitches. I like the way he attacks. I like the way he sequences. He had a pretty good year in 2017, you know, 144 strikeouts and 155 innings, 3.88 ERA, 1.23 whip. He's got a pretty solid curveball that had, but, you know, and a decent changeup too. It's that fastball that wasn't great. But, you know, since 2017, there have been a lot of bad fastball pitchers that have kind of shown that by utilizing the fastball up in the zone more and the breaking stuff low, that they can kind of hide the fastball. So I'm cautiously optimistic on Montgomery, actually.
I'm with you. I grabbed him at the end of a, I can't remember if it was a 12-team qualifier or a 15-team other league. I had too many leagues already this year. But I have at least one Montgomery share for sure. I know him. That was before Severino's. That was just in the wake of James Paxton. So I'm on board with Montgomery. He should be healthy and ready to roll. You got Loaisiga and some others that are going to be kind of moving around there. Eventually, Paxton will be back. But Montgomery, I am with you, that should stick around for quite some time. So big fan of that one.
And the key thing to remember about Loaisiga or you know, Davey Garcia or whoever, if they bring it up, is we got Paxton coming back. But then also after 80 games, you got Domingo Germán coming back off suspension. So even if Paxton comes back and then you say, oh, you know, he's an injury prone pitcher and he's, you know, maybe he gets hurt again. Well, if he comes back, pitches for a month or so, you know, month and a half, gets hurt. Now you're almost got Domingo Germán taking that spot. So I think you're really looking at one spot in this rotation, at least for the season. But, you know, you got to play for April 1st and then see how players progress and who you're cutting and who you're holding on to.
Well, how about this guy going to Cincinnati here? Eugenio Suarez coming off a near 50 home run season last year. People were hyped that he had a swimming pool accident, had surgery on his shoulder. We saw like pictures last week that he's taking ground balls. Everyone was getting pretty pumped up on it. And now we're getting reports he still can't swing or throw, which is concerning as all get up to me. Shoulder injuries are not good at all. He's going around pick 95 over the last 2 weeks in online drafts and FBC, as low as 129. I was pretty happy about the idea of him coming back. Now I don't even know if I can draft him. What's your thoughts on Suarez?
Yeah, he's another tough one. I mean, they refer to it as loose cartilage in his right shoulder. Obviously, he's a righty, so that's his throwing shoulder. As a right-handed hitter, too, you're getting a lot of power from the top hand. So, I mean, it's tough. You know, if the price is right, if he starts dropping that max pick you were talking about around the 120s, 130s, you know, I'm willing to roll the dice as we get and buy in as we get to that type of ADP. Just thinking that, you know, if he gets hurt and I need to move on, then so be it. I need to move on. I mean, you know, you're looking right now in the 130 ADPs of like the, you know, Tommy Edmonds and Danny Santana's, Kevin Biggio. So I would argue none of those guys are really a sure thing. And so I'm okay taking Suarez in that same range and, you know, just kind of hoping for the shoulder to be good.
Yeah. The talent's no doubt. It's just a matter of what's that shoulder doing. So I guess we'll have to wait and see how that keeps developing this spring. Speaking of shoulders, JD Davis of the New York Mets, left a couple days ago, the shoulder injury MRIs came back with no structural damage. But what are you doing with JD Davis? You know, Yoenis Cespedes looks like he's ready to rock and roll this year in a contract season. You still have Dom Smith out there. They say it might platoon with him. Playing time might not be as clear-cut as we once hoped for the StatCast darling JD Davis. Are you still trying to draft him with upside this year?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still interested in JD Davis. I mean, I think, you know, all he's ever really done is hit. I mean, he hit throughout the minor league career. There was a brief – his first call-up with Houston – he struggled a little bit, but, you know, I mean, for the majority of his career, he's proven he can hit. You know, he's got some ability to move over the field. The Mets have a long history of having guys get banged up. I'd love to see Cespedes out there, you know, mm-hmm. for the majority of the season. I'm not going to shy away from JD Davis because of Cespedes. If it happens, so be it. It's been a while since he's been on the field. So I don't consider that a major threat right now, especially when you look at where JD Davis is going in drafts. I mean, you know, in the TG FBI draft, his average pick is 176. So nice. You're already talking late enough in drafts where he's going that I still think the upside is worth it. Especially because you're getting that multi-position eligibility, and he's got places where the Mets will find a way to get his bat in the lineup if he's healthy. I truly believe if he hits, he's going to play. I still see a path for, you know, 450, 500 at bats, which is, you know, enough for him to post, you know, 20 plus home runs and be worth a pick near 200 if you're looking for some power.
In the NFBC right now, JD Davis is going to pick 180. At 170, at 179 is Justin Turner. Would you rather have Davis or Turner?
I think Turner. Yeah. I just kind of trust the at-bats more. The mm-hmm. offense there is better. So I think he'll get some more counting stats. Obviously, you hate to lose that position flexibility that JD Davis has. It's always good, especially if you're in like a daily moves league or something like that. But I would go Turner.
Another third base outfielder going eight picks behind him, Hunter Dozier. Dozier or Davis?
Ooh, that's a tough one.
I think they're very similar players.
I think right now, I think I'd go Dozier. I'm buying mm-hmm. into last year, and that's another one where if you're giving me the same multi-position eligibility, I'll take the locked-in plate appearances.
Yeah, the difference between the two is Dozier's pretty much locked into everyday at-bats. So I'm with you.
Exactly.
There. Yeah. Yeah. Let's go to the LA Dodgers for me. I just want to bring him up. Dustin May. I've talked about him a ton on this show. I'm a huge Dustin May fan. Reports came out recently that he's going to start the season in the minor leagues. I tried to twist it with a grain of salt. It means they're going to keep him as a starter. So that's good. But now there's reports that he's got, you know, side discomfort. He hasn't resumed throwing yet. That's going to set him back at all. Are you going to take any chances on him in a draft and just try to hold on to him, hoping he comes up early, or is this kind of scaring you off?
I don't think I'm taking chances in a redraft league, and it's not so much the side issue, even though that doesn't help. It's I just don't know where he's going to throw. I mean, you've got Kershaw, Buehler, Price, Wood, Urias, Gonsolin, Stripling. Those guys are all arguably ahead of him for starts. And you know the way that the Dodgers like to kind of manipulate the innings. So even if you know, Dustin May gets called up, he's on your roster, he's going to get a start, he's up. How long is he up for? How many starts are you getting? Are they just going to send him back down to the minors? Because if they send him to the minors, you can't throw him in an IL spot. You know, you've got to just leave him sitting on your bench. So for me, I think this year in a redraft only league, that's a headache that I don't know that I want to deal with. I don't see him with the upside of somebody who's going to, you know, get a couple good starts and then all of a sudden be locked into the rotation and throw 120 innings for the major league club this year.
Yeah, it's harder and harder every day for me to be willing to take him. I had some of him earlier because I thought there was a chance he'd start the year in the rotation, and then that's been poo-pooed away. So yeah. That's really, really sucking there. Last bit of news here. There's other news out there, but he's just the relevant ones at this point in time. Tommy Pham, this kind of stinks. He played through an elbow injury all last year. We saw it affect him at times offensively for the Rays, now with the Padres. And he's already showing discomfort in that elbow, and they're kind of, you know, playing it slow with him to try to keep him healthy. But the fact it's lingering now, you almost think he's a New York Yankee, but he's playing for the Padres. Is this scaring you off at all? Because he's up to pick 71-ish right now. He's going right after Whit Merrifield, right before Lewis Robert, Ramon Laureano and company in the outfield. Is this concerning you at all?
Today, right now, no. I did a little digging as much as I could. I mean, this is, you know, one of those things where we're getting some vague coach speak from the organization. But right now, what I read is that they're referring to it as general soreness. Now, you know, he had an elbow issue. He's going through a rehab. He's going through a throwing program. I think anytime you're trying to, you know, rehab a ligament, soreness to me isn't a concern. I mean, soreness when you're working back from a prior injury would be normal. If it was pain, then, you know, I'm starting to get a little bit more concerned. You know, he's also an outfielder. He's not a pitcher. So soreness in your throwing arm is not as big of a deal as somebody who's got to throw, you know, 80 to 100, 120 pitches in a day. So if I take them at face value that this is just soreness that they're monitoring as he recovers, I'm not too concerned. But it's definitely something that I think is worth keeping an eye on over the next few days.
Yeah, it'll be worth monitoring for sure. Let's go to the TGFBI now. This has been a fun one. Justin Mason, year three of this great fantasy baseball invitational he's created that has been great. My third year doing it. Is this your first or second year, Eric?
It's my first year in it, and I've been watching from afar the last few years, and I kind of am loving this opportunity to get in and you know, try my hand at it.
Yeah, it's a ton of fun. I love how it's grown every year, and I think it's fun. This year, I'm in a league where I know only like two or three guys, which is fun for me because I love getting to know so many more people in the industry because there's a ton of great minds that are out there. What league are you in this year?
I'm in League 19.
League 19. All right. Who is in your league? Let's just start with the basics here.
Let's see. I can go. I'm trying to pull up the document and see if I can go through the whole thing. Man, what is Eddie's last name?
Eddie Alvarez? Almaguer?
Yeah. Who's like, I think he was the number one overall player based on his last 3-year record.
He's the OG. That's
fun. And then Adam Ronis is in the league. And I think he was somewhere top 10 in his overall performance. And then, you know, there's a couple guys that I know that I read some of their stuff, on Twitter. So it's Justin, I think it's Paradis, but, from, Pitcher List, Mike Maher's in there. Eric Halterman's in there. Steven Humans is in there. Corey Steiner. So it's a pretty solid league. I mean, you know, there are some guys I was familiar with before, some guys I wasn't, but just kind of seeing the way that everybody's approaching it, you know, it's interesting to be in a league with a lot of sharp minds.
No doubt about it. What round are you guys in right now?
I'm about to make my 11th round pick. I was picking out of the seven spot, so I'm pick 157 right now.
I have the seventh spot, and I'm four picks from my 11th round pick too. So before you make your 11th pick, why don't you give us your roster so far? Who have you taken?
All right. So I'll go down through it in order. So at seven, I took Mookie Betts. 24, I went Chris Sale. And then Altuve at 37, Blackman at 54, Nelson Cruz, 67, Tim Anderson at 84, Mike Moustakas at 97. So that gave me all hitters and Sale. And then I loaded up on, or I went all pitching the last three spots and took Zach Gallen at 114, bought into the Edwin Diaz rebound at 127, and then took Kyle Hendricks at 144 to solidify the ratios. I figure, you know, him and Sale, I don't mind as a pairing, because Sale will get me a boatload of Ks, and he can balance out for Hendricks, you know, lack of Ks, but it's a real solid ratio floor for me.
Are you assuming, since you took Sale, you have no concerns about him, do you?
I wouldn't say no concerns, but I just felt like, you know, my strategy going in was I was gonna get an ace, and then I like a lot of the starters going in the range where I took some, and then some guys still coming up later, like around the 200s, that are some high upside guys, a lot of young guys with a ceiling. So I knew I wanted an ace, an anchor, and I was hoping it was going to be DeGrom at seven. When he went right before me, I thought, you know, I'll take the upside of Sale over, you know, the Biebers and Flaherty's, and, you know, trying to wait around for those guys. I think that when he's on, he is arguably the starting pitcher number one. And, you know, I know that they're taking every precaution possible with his arm. I'm just going to roll the dice and kind of hope that it's not a multi-year thing. I think, you know, he is a very competitive dude, and last year seemed to bother him. And I don't see any reason why he wouldn't have taken every precaution possible to make sure that whatever it was that was, you know, plaguing him is fixed.
All right, I see you got a little less than 20 minutes for this pick. I found your page here. I'll ask a couple more questions before we make the pick. I had the fortune of having Jacob DeGrom fall into my lap at seven. Mm-hmm. If Cole or DeGrom would have been available, would you have still taken Betts, or do you take one of the big guns?
I take one of the big arms. I still, even with the way it fell out for me, I still like the idea of grabbing an ace and then loading up on the bats and trying to start grabbing pitchers around, you know, around seven, eight, and nine. I think that's my strategy right now this year.
Yeah, I don't mind that at all. When you went through here, I like the Tim Anderson pick. I think he's got sneaky upside in that one. I love Moose. I'm huge on him. I got Zach Gallen at the same exact spot you did, which is kind of funny. That's the only pick we share, but I have a lot of these guys in other leagues. But I love Gallen.
I pushed it with my goal was I wanted Wheeler. I was actually going to take Wheeler at 97. I'm really, really high on him this year. And I had an eye on the ADP, and I kept seeing that his ADP, even in TGFBI, was around like 118. And I was just, I got greedy, and I thought, okay, I'm at 114. His ADP is close to 120. Maybe I'll push it. And Wheeler went two picks before me, and I took Gallen as my consolation prize, and I'm not too sad about it. I think Sale, Gallen, and Hendricks gives me a real solid floor of starters, and then I can load up on the upside guys and hope that, you know, two or three of them really pop.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And when you took Edwin Diaz, it's funny because I took Gallen, and there's like four closers on the board. I'm like, okay, I'd love Diaz to come to me, and then Rodgers, Diaz, Jansen, and someone else went off the board. So I took Brad Hand there, which I'm not like in love with Brad Hand, but he was one of the last big closers left. So in an overall content,
you never want to root for injuries. But the Emmanuel, is it Class A?
Class A. Yeah.
So the Emmanuel Class A injury right now, at least it gives a little more breathing room for Hand. It's not one less guy breathing down his neck. I was happy to get Diaz where I got him. I saw, you know, Ariel Cohen, who is also writing for Rotoballer right now. He's obviously a huge Mets fan, but he took Diaz in the seventh and was super happy about being able to get Diaz there. So the fact that I was able to get him in the ninth, I felt like it was really good value there.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So you have one closer, three starters, couple outfielders, second base, shortstop, technically second or third, and your utility filled up. Where are you going with your 11th round pick?
So I've narrowed it down to three different directions. So the first, I could go catcher and take Wilson Contreras. It's a two catcher league, so I do like the idea of having one solid option. I was not planning to take a catcher this early, but you know, Wilson Contreras is now about 30 picks beyond his ADP. He's, you know, normally going in like 129, 130, and I'm at 157. I have him as in my rankings. I have him as the fourth best catcher, still just ahead of Mitch Garver. I kind of have them back to back, so I could go there. I hadn't planned on doing that. Another could go, but hadn't planned on is I told myself I wouldn't draft Danny Santana, but he's just sitting there staring at me with his dual position eligibility and potential 2020 season. And I like where I'm at with stolen bases in terms of, you know, Betts and Altuve and Tim Anderson are, you know, Betts and Anderson are probably 20 stolen base guys or close to it. Altuve is, you know, 10 to maybe 15, but probably around 10. But I could use another guy to give me 20 some odd stolen bases. I was kind of hoping that Edmund or Kingery would fall here, and they didn't. So in that same vein, I'm also kind of buying in on the Lorenzo Cain bounce back. Yeah. And I know his ADP is lower, or, you know, it's 182, but right now in terms of just TGFBI, you know, he's been going, let's see, his TGFBI ADP is 158. And he's been drafted in 14 leagues, and I'm at 157, so it plays into his ADP in the TGFBI leagues. I think that, you know, he was hurt last year, so I think that 20 stolen bases is maybe his floor if he's healthy, and he could push 25 plus. And I'm just not sure how many guys left have that in them.
Yeah, the Kane one's very, very intriguing. Like, I won't tell you how I rank them. I'll see you pick first, but the Kane one's very intriguing. So go ahead. Who are you taking with your 11th pick?
Oh man, we're gonna put on the spot. I'm definitely. I just can't buy into Danny Santana.
Me neither.
I'm sure he's a great guy, but I just it's too much of the late blooming for me. I should have mentioned also. What are your thoughts on Kyle Tucker?
Okay, so I had James Anderson from RotoWire on the show yesterday, on Wednesday. And I've been so back and forth on Kyle Tucker because I know the potential is huge, but is he going to play, so on and so forth. He says everything they see scouting-wise last year, you're not going to see in the big leagues. Like, he could still hit like 25 home runs, but he's not stealing all those bags in the bigs. Like, he'd probably be more like a 15 to 20 steals guy, which is still awesome. Mm-hmm. But you're hoping for the best case scenario and you're hoping for playing time. So he's one of those, I guess, that if he blasts off like he could, he's a league winner. But there's a ton of question marks. And where he's getting drafted, it's not worth it to me. And James kind of felt the same way.
Yeah, he's out there for me, and that's why I didn't even bring him up to you to start it off. I don't think I can do it. I'm between Kane and Wilson Contreras. And if I look at my plan for the next two or three rounds, depending on who I pick here.
See, I'm like you. I usually don't take catchers early, but in a two-catcher league with an overall – I try to get one of the big – like I took Gary Sanchez in the seventh, and I never do that. but it's one of those. I usually punt catchers, even a two catcher league, but I think it just sets you back so far. Like, I'm not saying you have to get Contreras, but pretty soon you're going to have to start getting somebody.
Yeah.
And that definitely changes things instead of waiting forever.
Yeah. I've got some guys still left out there that I like. I mean, the only four catchers have gone in my league so far. Okay. So I think there are some guys out there, but oh man, this is the thing, right? You get down to it and then it's tough. I think, you know, my gut is telling me that as much as I like Kane, that this might be a little early to bank on those stolen bases, to just pull for the stolen bases. I think I'm going to take Contreras and lock in one of my catchers.
Yeah, I don't hate it. It's a big time catcher. You're locking in there. I like the Kane upside. I think there's a lot to like about it, but I think Contreras is the way to go in this scenario. Out of those three guys you mentioned, I think that's definitely the way to go. So Jose Contreras, or Wilson Contreras, sorry. I love it. Really intriguing play there. Can't wait to see where you go. Oh, auto picked Edwin Encarnacion right away. You got to love it. Guys on auto pick are God's blessings to drafts.
You know, a couple nights ago, I was three picks away, and it was, you know, just I had to go to sleep. Put four guys in the queue, set the auto, and Severino was still at the top of the board because they hadn't taken him out yet. And went to bed freaking out that I was going to have screwed something up and wake up with Severino on my team.
Don't you love the world of fantasy baseball we live in?
Yeah.
It's so amazing. TGFBI, it's been pretty awesome. We'll revisit this at some other time and see how things keep going out, but it's fun having you in the seventh spot and watching your draft board and seeing the different way it moves compared to where I'm sitting at right now. But I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things you're working on. You talked about them at the beginning of the show. So we'll talk with about OAA right out the gate. You mentioned how you're seeing it outs above average and the new additions they're making. So what new additions are they making that are making you dig into it more often?
So I think that the key thing was the inclusion of the infielders. Right, because it's great to have OAA for outfield. It's just nice to see which guys are actually, recording outs above the average for their position. I mean, you know, we tend to know who the good outfielders are because we see the highlights all the time. But with infielders, it's actionable for so many more positions because of how much it impacts a pitcher. You know, you look at a pitcher with a ground ball percentage that's around 50% or over, he's relying on that infield defense a lot to ensure, you know, his ratios, to ensure, you know, his wins, his innings, all that sort of stuff. So the more information we get on the actual quality of a defense, the better. And what I even haven't even begun to dug into is that, is that OAA actually not only will say like, so for example, one of the biggest things that I found that was interesting was it'll break down by the position within the position that person is at too. So for example, when they look at like Jonathan Scope, right? Jonathan Scope ranked 29th overall on the OAA leaderboard. But if you click on his individual breakdown, it actually shows where on the field, not just the position of second base, his best plays came from. And that essentially he was most effective as an infielder when he was shifted to basically be playing over the bag at second base. So I haven't even begun to look at that where you're thinking like, okay, so, you know, as a normal second baseman playing, the position that were or where he's set on maybe 75% of plays, he was an average fielder. But when they shift him, he becomes above average in the shift based on positioning. So, you know, because this is the first year they've done that, it's like, is that fluky? Is that kind of actionable information? Or is it just kind of a way, is it propping up an otherwise average defender? So it's been interesting to kind of dig into that and compare it to, you know, UZR and some of the other fielding metrics and try to see if it's, you know, how much weight to put on it.
So when you're developing these for pitchers, you said you broke some of them down. What are you trying to gain out of looking at the pitcher situation? Because, like, when I go to the outs above average leaderboard, it just the first page is, you know, Victor Robles, Javi Baez, Kevin Kiermaier, all these guys. When you're looking at it from a pitcher standpoint, what are you trying to garner out of that?
So on the tab, you know, you can set it to when you go on there, you can set it to view and you can set it to pitcher, and it will actually tell you, you know, as it says, this table shows the performance of the defense behind the pitcher while he was on the mound, not the fielding performance of the pitcher himself. So you can see the way the defense performed while the pitcher was pitching. So one of the guys, you know, I spoke to you about earlier, the first one that pops off the page is Dakota Hudson was number one last year in OAA while he was on the mound. The defense when he was on the mound was 16 outs above average. The number two pitcher in baseball was Miles Michaelis, and the defense behind him was 8 outs above average. So the defense behind Dakota Hudson was 2 times better than the defense behind the second best or the number two pitcher in all of baseball. So to me, that's a ridiculous outlier. That's not sustainable no matter what type of pitcher Dakota Hudson is. At some point, that regresses to the mean, which is why, you know, not that I was in on Dakota Hudson to begin with, but why he's kind of a prime example of a guy that I think OAA is telling us, you know, to stay away from or to pump the brakes on a little bit.
And ironically, on the same team, the St. Louis Cardinals. So sure. Something to keep in mind there as well.
Yeah, that's another cool thing about OAA is, you know, when you have the view tab, you can view it by fielding team. And then obviously, you know, if you view it by fielding team, the Cardinals were the number one team by OAA by a full 9 outs last year, which is why a lot of their pitchers were higher. And, you know, that's because of the quality of that infield behind them. I mean, you know, you look at, you know, Colton Wong, Paul DeJong was 7th overall. Colton Wong was 13th. Carpenter was 25th. Goldschmidt was 33rd. So that's, any St. Louis Cardinals pitcher is going to have the value of that defense behind them.
Gotcha. You mentioned the likes of, say, Luke Weaver, and he comes up on the list. I just saw him. He had, I believe, 7 outs above average is what they're showing here. What are you getting out of Luke Weaver that got your attention?
So Luke Weaver was somebody I was interested in just because he's, you know, he's kind of being discussed as this prime sleeper right now. So I wanted to see, what if there was anything actionable with Luke Weaver in terms of this being something that we could buy into. I think the key for me was then using the defensive metric. OAA itself doesn't explain everything, but it says, okay, this pitcher got better than average defense or below average defense. Why do we think that is? For Weaver in particular, I think it's he changed his pitch mix. So in the second half of 2018, he was a four-seam fastball changeup curveball guy. And in 2019, he started adding a cutter, and the cutter replaced his curveball basically, which was his primary pitch for just like a get me over strike. And that pitch posted a 263 batting average against a 158 ISO. So it was huge for limiting contact. So when you look at it and then you say, okay, so he adds a pitch which is designed to get soft contact, which then is a pitch that requires or is then benefited by having a good defense behind you. So Ben, that tells me a little bit more about whether that's actionable for Luke Weaver or not. And last year, the Diamondbacks had the 5th best defense based on OAA. So, you know, you got a pitcher throwing to contact, getting ground balls, solid defense behind him. That tells me that a lot of that success is actually something that can be sustainable.
Okay. I like that. Another interesting name on the list that's been kind of depends on what camp you sit in is Sonny Gray. Some people love him. Some people not so much. Another guy, 7 outs above average. I'm seeing like 92% success rate is estimated success rate is 90%. So for the most part, seem pretty good. But I know there's a lot of mixed reviews on Sonny Gray. What were you seeing on him?
So I looked at that and I was surprised because I don't think we normally think of the Reds as having a great defense. They did have a top 10 defense based on OAA last year. And then you dig into it and you're like, okay, part of the reason for that is Jose Iglesias at shortstop. They played Jose Iglesias for most of the time at shortstop last year. He was OAA's ninth ranked overall fielder. If you use UZR, he's a 5.9 UZR at short. You know, they're bringing in Freddie Galvis this year, which isn't a major drop off, but it's not Jose Iglesias. And then if they're fully healthy, they have Mike Moustakas playing at second base. So Moustakas had a full season at second base. He was below average defender at second base. So now you start to see that defense that Gray had last year might not be the same defense that he has this year in terms of overall quality. And then you look at the fact that in 2018, his overall BABIP was 326. And in 2019, his BABIP was 255. So he was getting already crazy lucky last year in terms of BABIP. If you go to his StatCast page and even look by pitch, the batting average against on his curve was 131. The batting average against on his slider was 117. Those just aren't, they're not sustainable numbers. They're not in line with his career record or his career track record. So I think you have to anticipate some BABIP regression and a potentially worse defense behind him. So that causes me to pump the brakes a little bit on believing some of what was there last year. Now, again, it's not to say he's a bad pitcher, but I'm not buying a sub-3 ERA.
Definitely. If the BABIP increases like it should and a worse defense, lots to point in that range. So that's interesting to look at because I've looked at the BABIP in most scenarios. I haven't thought about the defense the way it describes it here. So interesting way to go about it. Let's look at a couple in the reverse direction here. Adrian Houser. Let's talk about a guy that does not get many outs above average. Actually, doesn't get any, it appears. What does this give you intrigued to maybe buy into Houser or just give you more concern for Houser?
I got to tell you, I'm big on Houser coming into this year. I wish I could, you know, I've got reasons. You know, I don't know if they're all rational or not. Maybe it's a little bit of just, you know, you want to have a guy on your team who, you know, throws up on the field in the middle of the game and you just pull for a guy like that. You know, but as you mentioned, he was five outs below average last year. A lot of that has to do with let me go to his page real quick. I think there's an improved defense behind him. So right now they have Eric Sogard penciled in at third base. He was the 27th best infielder in OAA last year. Travis Shaw was 70th. So that's an improvement. You've got Justin Smoke, who is an above average first baseman, now likely going to play the majority of the games at first base as a lefty. So he'll be in against righties. Keston Hiura was the 130th ranked fielder in OAA. I looked at a bunch of, you know, I don't have as much of a knowledge of his minor league fielding as, you know, some of the minor league guys, but I read a bunch of his reports. He doesn't seem to be that much of a below average fielder. You'd have to assume he gets a little bit more comfortable at the major league level. So you've got improvements at two positions with new fielders, and then you've got a likely improvement with a young player. And then whenever Luis Urias is healthy, he was a much better fielder by OAA than Orlando Arcia last year. So you have upgrades at all four positions on the field. And that's before you even get into the fact that I just like a lot of what Houser does. Now, Houser is a pitcher who only has a 9.6 swinging strike percentage and a low 27.5 O swing. He has a 53.4 ground ball percentage. So he induces weak ground ball contact. So when you have a pitcher who induces lots of weak ground ball contact, who was getting below average defense behind him last year, but still put up a 3.72 ERA and is now going to get better, arguably better defense behind him this year. I really don't see why people are starting to, you know, predict a mid fours, high fours ERA. I don't know if it's 3.72, but I don't see any reason why he can't hover around four or just under four. And I think that, you know, he's not a guy who's going to give you a lot of Ks, but I do like him as a late round option. He's got a great, you know, two seamer sinker, depending on, you know, where you're looking at and what they refer to it as, but it induces a lot of weak contact, has a lot of run on it.
Talking about weak contact and an improved Milwaukee defense, does this make you like Brandon Woodruff more, or is this more a Hauser thing?
No, I think it applies both ways. I mean, I think Hauser is a little more reliant on defense than Woodruff, who definitely misses more bats than Hauser. But I would say I'm in the camp that is buying into Woodruff more than the camp that's fading him.
Gotcha. And for the last one here, it's kind of fun as I've been scrolling around now, really never even looking at this page. Kind of goes back to the beginning of the podcast where I'm still learning so many stats. The very last guy, there's 277 players, pitchers on this list. And he has -9 outs above average. No one else has -9. And this could be because of that bad Reds defense we talked about, or some Indians defense as well. But it can't be this bad for Trevor Bauer again in 2020, can it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it can. What's interesting is that, you know, Trevor Bauer first came up on Rotoballer also about a month ago. Riley Mrack wrote an article on flyball metrics and looking at positive regression candidates for flyball metrics. And he, his article points to Bauer as a positive regression for flyball metrics. And then you also see that on top of the fact that his flyball rate was uncharacteristically high in terms of his career marks, and he gave up 20 home runs after giving up 19 in the previous 3 years combined. Then you also look at the fact that he technically, according to OAA, was the beneficiary of the worst defense of any pitcher who was measured. And then you have to think there's positive regression coming that way. I think it's just now coming in on too many different planes with too many different types of stats to suggest that Bauer won't regress. Regress to the mean, so won't kind of improve on his performance from last year.
So you mentioned how you've been digging into this. There's new developments in it. What's next for what you're going to work on with for Rotoball or just in general? What are you trying to completely like take out of this metric and use?
The next thing I'm doing is looking at new arms or sort of new teams, pitchers on new teams, and trying to see what the OAA about the fielding defense would suggest about where they're going. So for example, you know, everybody keeps talking about Marcus Stroman and, oh, Marcus Stroman's in the NL now. And you know, he's throwing the slider more and they're expecting, you know, a little bit more progression from him, more positive results. Well, the Blue Jays had the 12th best defense last year, according to OAA, and the Mets had the 24th. So, and the difference was in runs also is that the Blue Jays were five outs above average, and the Mets were 13 outs below average. So that's an 18 out swing. So if you're saying that Stroman is going to use that slider more and induce more ground ball contact, well, now he's off the turf, but he's got a worse defense behind him. So I'm not so sure I'm buying into Marcus Stroman in the NL is better than Marcus Stroman in the AL. So things like that is what I'm digging into right now and trying to identify some guys whose moves I think were beneficial for them and some guys whose moves may have been, you know, kind of like horizontal or maybe even put them in a worse spot.
Nice. Looking forward to checking that out. Last bit of a conversation for tonight's show. Barrel growth. I talked about earlier, barrels seems to be like the stickiest, most consistent kind of Statcast metric that we can use to show positive hitting, basically. It's the most simple way I can say, like, really good quality of contact, a good barrel rate. And there's guys that barrel rates continue to grow up year by year, go down year by year, fluctuate year by year. Lots of weird variances all over the place. You've been digging in on guys with growth and regression. So how about you give me a couple guys you've seen in the – let's start with the positive, glass half full situation. Give me a couple guys that you've seen some positive growth in barrel rates.
So I'll take this opportunity to get on my soapbox for somebody who I apparently am an unwilling or champion of. I did not know that I was going to continuously be so much higher on Rougned Odor than almost anybody else. But you know, Odor was the seventh. He had the seventh best growth in barrels. His barrels per batted ball event percentage in 2018 was 7.2. In 2019, it was 13.6. So he jumped 6.4% in terms of barrels per batted ball event. He has an 89.4 average exit velocity. He had 113.1 max exit velocity, which was basically only 1 mile per hour below Miguel Sano, who everybody says is, you know, one of the most powerful hitters in baseball. And then you look at, you know, it caused me to dig in on him a little bit more. You see Odor's O-swing has dropped in three consecutive years. Yes, his O-swing is still 33%. It's high, but it's a positive plate discipline metric. His walk percentage has increased over the last 3 years. So he's taking more walks, swinging outside the zone less incrementally over the last 3 years. He's consistently hitting for more barrels. He had 86th percentile hard hit percentage. He had a nearly 5-degree increase in his launch angle. And he has stolen, he's hit for 30 home runs and stolen at least 10 bases in three of the last 4 years. So a 30-10 guy going outside of the top 200 and a guy who's shown better plate discipline metrics and consistent barrel contact, I think I'm in on that.
Yeah, I'm with you. I love me some Rugi. He's going about pick 233 right now over the last 2 weeks in an FPC online championships. It's one of those things, if your team is comfortable in batting average, I love getting the power-speed combo. One thing I talk about on this show and other shows a lot is I want guys that can get me double digits in steals as many times as I can. Like, you can't do it with everybody. Like, I get it. You just can't. But especially in these later round guys, when you're taking gambles on bench players or later just options, like a Rougned Odor gets you 10 steals. You know, you go get a Trent Grisham late, gets you 15 plus steals. Mm-hmm. Things like that to just help your team out so much more in an overall contest. I love Odor. It's one of those things. We've seen him do it in the past. And you mentioned the gains he had in all of his hitting stats, all the barrels, the EVs, all that stuff you mentioned. If he can just put it together, maybe at 250, my goodness, what he could do for your team.
And it's funny you say 250 because Odor hit 205 last year. His K percentage was over 30%. And all of the underlying metrics, as we mentioned, were either the same as in the past or better than in the past. And his strikeout percentage was an anomaly. The year before, 2018, his strikeout percentage was 7% points lower. He hit 253. And in 2017, he also hit 204. So everybody has this notion that he's a 200 hitter. Well, in 2016, he hit 271. And in 2015, he hit 261. So basically, in three of the last 5 years, he's hit 250 or better. So he has it in him, and he's shown in the past that he can be a 250 hitter. He's only 26 years old. Sometimes I think we think that he's, because he's been around for, you know, almost 6 years, he broke through in 2014, that he's way older than he is. But, you know, you're giving me a 26-year-old hitter who's hit 250 or above in the majority of his Major League Baseball seasons, who's a 30-10 threat. I'll take that and bank on that over the 2 years that he was hitting at 200.
Yeah, and it's 428 XFO Bacon. I'm a big XFO Bacon fan, and when I see 428 on a guy that produced a 205 batting average, I like what could happen if he just, you know, just some minor tweaks could go a long, long way. So I'm a big Rugi fan with you as well. He's sucking me back in. Who's another guy that gained pretty well this year?
Another guy that's being drafted regularly in 12 team drafts would be Dansby Swanson. He had a 6% growth. He was 4.1% barrels per batted ball event in 2018, and he went to 10.1. I think Swanson's really interesting. We've talked about how deep shortstop is this year, and how, you know, you can fill your middle infield with a shortstop late in the drafts. I really like Swanson. That those numbers caused me to dig in on him. You know, he was on July 23rd, he hurt his heel. He missed a month, and then he returned. And when he returned, his stats were all out of whack. His strikeout percentage was like 13% points higher than before. He hit 17 homers before he got hurt. He hit zero after he got hurt. So I look at the full season and I say, all right, that injury definitely affected him. Jeff Zimmerman's done some great work about how playing through injuries hurts guys' numbers. But I look at a guy whose hard hit percentage has increased in each of the last 3 years. His ground ball percentage has decreased in each of the last 3 years. His zone swing percentage has increased, so he's being a little bit more aggressive. His exit velocity improved. His barrels jumped. And his XBA, his X batting average, was 271, which was compared to his actual batting average of 251. So you're telling me that I have a 260, 270 hitter who, you know, could actually pop 20 to 25 home runs and steal 10 plus bases, hitting at the top of a really good order. I mean, let's say he goes 20-10 and hits 260 with, you know, 70 RBIs, 80 runs. I mean, that's well worth a pick around 200, and he's going well after that right now.
I absolutely love Dansby Swanson. I've talked about him many times. You look, like you said, his StatCast page is ridiculous. Someone on Twitter today compared him to Gleyber Torres, and he's equal to or outgains him in almost every StatCast metric, which is beautiful to see. It was a matter of he was hurt last year, especially in the second half of the season. And, you know, when he hit towards the top of the order, he was doing really, really well. Bottom of the order, not so much. Right now, he's projected to hit like maybe six, which would be pretty good. I take that in a heartbeat. So I love Dansby. I think he's a great middle infield option or even an extra shortstop. Like, it's if depending on how your draft flows, there, I don't think there's anything wrong this year with having three shortstops in your lineup because there's so many good ones. So Dansby's a guy that I think it shows how deep the position is because he's so talented and it's hard to really argue with any of the guys ahead of him. Like, you could easily say Dansby can be over them at the same time. They're all pretty good in their own rights, so it's kind of like getting picky in the situation. It's just such a deep position, but he should be going higher than where he's going.
He should. So, that's why when we were talking TGFBI stuff, you know, I didn't even bring up that, you know, in the 11th round, I didn't expect, you know, Corey Seager's still out there, Jorge Polanco's still out there, Gene Segura's still out there, who's going to have shortstop second base eligibility because he's going to play second in Philly. Those are all guys that I love, and I didn't even think about taking them because there's just so many still out there that, you know, it's really – I actually think it's driving down the price of a lot of good shortstops because everybody is just saying, you know what, this position's deep, you can wait, and then you can wait on some guys that should be going maybe three full rounds earlier.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Give me one of the guys that's falling in the wrong direction.
One of the guys falling in the wrong direction is actually Jesus Aguilar. Jesus Aguilar and Eric Thames were almost exactly similar situations. So Aguilar was down 11.4% barrels per batted ball event to 7.5. Eric Thames was down from 16.7%, which is a crazy high percentage of barrels per batted ball event and likely unsustainable, to 9.3. But what I thought was interesting about both of them was their exit velocities stayed the same as they were in their strong years. Their launch angles were still where we want them to be. Their sweet spot percentage was still up above major league average. Eric Thames's sweet spot percentage was basically in line with his 2018. Both of their K percentages went down, and Jesus Aguilar's walk percentage went up. So you're looking at guys who are still hitting the ball hard, are still hitting the ball at a launch angle that's preferable for home runs, are not striking out as much, and their barrels just went down. They weren't getting as much good contact as they did the year before. To me, I really think that, and this is something where we'll bring it all back full circle to the start of the podcast. I think sometimes you get things that stats don't tell you. Both of those guys are in platoon situations last year. They're not getting consistent playing time. There are days on end where they're sitting on the bench, especially when you're a power hitter like that. You know, it is a lot of rhythm, seeing the ball. And, you know, when you don't get to establish that rhythm, when you have maybe an 0-for-3 or, you know, an 0-for-9 stretch, and then you're sitting and you're kind of stewing on it for a while, there is a sense that if you're still hitting the ball hard in general, but I'm not getting as many barrels, what it tells me is they're a little bit off. Mm-hmm. They're not all off. It's not broken. It's not last year's Travis Shaw. It's something that's maybe these guys get out of a platoon situation or as heavy of a platoon situation as they were in last year, and they're able to regain a little bit more of the 2018 magic, which is actually kind of why I like them in their new situations. I mean, I think Aguilar is locked into plate appearances in Miami, and Thames is on the right side of a platoon in Washington. And I kind of think at the end of a draft, these are guys who maybe the barrel percentage dropping is more of a red herring and is going to lead people away from them when we shouldn't be running away from them.
Yeah, it's a good point, the platoon thing, because you can't get in a rhythm. Your timing's off. I think there's a lot to be said about that, because Aguilar was just a mess last year. Mm-hmm. Absolute mess. Thames would have his moments, but still kind of sketchy. Like you mentioned, Thames goes to Washington, platooning with Ryan Zimmerman. Still the strong side, and Aguilar shouldn't have any issue getting playing time. Actually, Aguilar is a very intriguing late-round corner infield-type power bat that he's literally got 35-plus home run upside if he figures it out. He's going about pick 340. Eric Thames about pick 360 right now. There's some other guys like Justin Smoke at 357. You got Howie Kendrick at 351. Evan White for the Mariners at 349. So it's an interesting group at the back end of your first base corner infield type situation. Anybody else that stood out as drops?
Randall Grichuk stood out as a drop. I mean, I do, you know, one of the biggest drops was Chris Davis. I think that was just based on his hip.
I'm
still buying back way in. You know, Randall Grichuk is somebody I keep hearing about. If you need power late in drafts, you know, draft Randall Grichuk. Sure. I mean, you know, he had 31 home runs last year. He had 25 the year before. You know, he can certainly hit home runs. I see an exit velocity that's lower than I want for a power hitter. I see a declining barrel percentage for 3 years in a row. You know, I see a declining sweet spot percentage for 3 years in a row. I see declining X stats for 3 years in a row. I see declining XWO bacon for 3 years in a row. So, I mean, I think if you need power late, you know, I'd much rather, I'd much rather at their cost, I'd much rather, you know, wait on a guy like Thames or Aguilar than take Grichuk, who's, you know, at least the last time I looked, is going, you know, in the, like 270 range.
Yeah, 278, yeah.
Right, as opposed to those, you know, mid 300 numbers you're calling out for some of the other guys. So I'm not buying in on Grichuk as a power source late in drafts. I just think that there's so much power going around you know, in the league that I think I just don't know that if he continues his trend of declining numbers, I think you might be looking at another like 24 home run season, 25, and that's fine. but it's not something that you're going to be super happy about. I
yeah,
do want to
find what's common also.
Yeah. I do want to plug for the positives. Another guy that I've been championing the whole way, and it's I might regret it because we're in a two catcher league right now. But if you take his last full year as a starter, so that was 2017, and compare that to last year, 2019, the player whose barrel percentage grew more, barrels per batted ball event percentage grew more than anybody was Jason Castro.
I love Castro. His StatCast page is amazing.
It's great. And he got lost in the shuffle because he was on the same team as Mitch Garver, and Mitch Garver was the breakout darling last year. And, you know, rightfully so. Mitch Garver deserves, you know, all the talk and the attention and the love that he's getting. But Jason Castro had a great year last year. Now he finds himself as the starting catcher in Los Angeles in a good lineup. As a left-handed bat, and I just think that there's an opportunity there for him, you know, to not only be able to accumulate some RBIs and runs with the top of that lineup hitting behind him, but I see no reason why he can't push 20 home runs if he's, you know, able to get 400 plus plate appearances in that lineup, which I think happens.
Completely agree. I even in TGFBI last year, because I wasn't as aggressive on catchers, I was playing Castro off and on the entire season. Like when Garver was hurt and stuff, Castro was a regular in my lineup. And then when Garver came back, I couldn't, you know, afford the situation that was there. But he's a heck of a hitter out there. He's a really good defensive catcher, which keeps him in the rotation a lot more than people think. That's why I'm still kind of telling people, like, Garver, I get, was a beast at the plate. I expect some regression there. He's still really good, but his defense isn't great, and they brought Avila in, and Avila is a very good defensive catcher. Baldelli loves his defensive guys. So I'm not saying Garver can't be good, but Garver got a lot of time at first base last year too. Now Miguel Sano is going to be there. So keep that in mind. He'll still be good. It's just hard for me to reach for him in situations. But I love the Castro call, 23rd catcher off the board, about 335.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting though, because he's gone as high as 284. I have a feeling that TGFBI is going to go much higher. He's one of those guys, the more we talk about him, I've heard him in a lot of shows lately. Like, I wrote him up a long time ago in my rankings and stuff as my late round sleeper catcher. I'm starting to see a lot more people mention him. I'm getting really nervous. He's going to start climbing up draft boards. And then it's kind of like, is he going to be worth it type thing?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I think, you know, he's not catching 140, 150 games. And I think that, you know, there are few catchers out there who do that. And as he starts climbing, you know, maybe it doesn't become worth the price anymore, which would be sad, because I kind of think TGFBI in a two catcher league might be the only league for me to reasonably be rostering Jason Castro. And I really want to, but you know, I guess we'll have to see. I'm kind of hoping I still get my share of him in TGFBI, but you know, I'm not gonna go crazy. There are some guys that are slipping in two catchers that I would, you know, take and be sad about, but you know, still survive.
And you mentioned something there is, you know, not many catchers catch that many games anymore. And I can't remember the number off the top of my head right now, but I wrote the catcher preview in the Fantasy Black Book, Joe Pisapia's book, and I broke down kind of the, you know, X amount of guys only caught this many games. X, like, it's not like the old days where every main starter caught 140 plus games. It really doesn't happen anymore. There were a lot of guys, because a lot of catchers now DH, play first base also, it feels like, that were playing between 90 and 110 games on like all these teams. A lot of them were. So there's a point in the two catcher league that if they're consistently producing like a Jason Castro at 125 or 130 games, they're still a great asset, like a really good asset. So there's a lot to be said. It's one of those things where in daily leagues where I hate rostering extra catchers, but like the Barf league I'm in, it's a two catcher league, but it's daily leagues. I literally have Kurt Suzuki and Yan Gomes on my roster. I have three catchers, and I hate it because I hate having three catchers on my roster. Yeah. At the same time, I'll always have the Nationals catcher in the lineup, like stuff like that.
True. Yeah.
So lots of ways to approach it, but Eric, this was a blast. Time flew.
I know.
We were chatting this up.
Had a great time.
No problem. What else? What do you got coming up at Rotoballer? Plug away your Twitter account, all that good stuff.
So the Twitter account is at SamskiNYC. That's SamskiNYC. Right now, a lot of TGFBI on the Twitter account. I've got the OAA stuff coming out at Rotoballer. And then I'm actually, you know, you brought it up at the beginning of the show, the idea of line drive percentage. I'm going to start digging into line drive percentage and looking over the last 3 years and see whose line drive percentages have, you know, increased. And if we can kind of look at changes in line drive percentage as a way to project who might be breaking out or not. So I'm going to dig into that research now and kind of see what we can pull out from there.
Oh, I can't wait to check it out. It's been a pleasure reading your stuff and getting you on the pod. And I can't wait to have you on again sometime. So we'll definitely do this again in the future.
Can't wait.
All right, everybody. This is Bench with Bubba, episode 253 with Eric Smolski of Rotoballer, talking TGFBI, recent news, barrels, outs above average, all kinds of cool stuff. So go check him out on Twitter, and we will catch you guys next time.
Life's better with an auto policy from American Family Insurance. No matter what dreams you're driving towards. That's because our expert agents will make you feel totally protected with the right auto coverage at the right price. You'll also save up to 23% when you bundle auto with home. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.